Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
We got an oven-ready deal. Put it in the microwave. We can get a new deal. We're aiming for a new deal. I've looked carefully at no deal. That outcome would be a failure of statecraft. The people of this country deserve better from their leaders.
About the negotiations, sir.
We're very happy to be back to London. We continue the work.
We continue the work.
Patience and determination.
And will you get a deal, sir?
Hello.
Let's be absolutely clear. This country can prosper and will prosper mightily in either event. And if we have to come out with a so-called Australian style model, Australian relationship with the EU, we will make a great success of it.
An Australian deal, of course, is no deal. Let's not kid ourselves. Good afternoon and welcome to Countdown to Brexit. I'm Stephen Ritson with you here for the next hour. This is our series of Monday programmes until the 4th of January, when we'll definitely be, this is a definite one, definitely be out of the transition period. Bit of a bizarre day to be doing this programme because bugger all has happened. I mean, really, Barnier, was it, they're keeping tight-lipped. It's tumbleweed as far as anything sort of specific. What we think we might know is the Times newspaper reported on Saturday that the European Commission has started to lean on Michel Barnier to get a deal with Britain. The report said that Boris Johnson is expected to speak to EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen anytime now, within the next maybe 24, 36 hours, to try and find common ground on fish. Fishing quotas, of course, is the thing. If we got one word out of Barnier as he was leaving those discussions with David Frost in London, it was this word. See if you can pick it up.
Mr. Barnier, is it too late to get a deal?
Hello.
Did you get anywhere with fishing rights, Mr. Barnier?
It's very low there. Poisson, he said. Poisson, of course, fish. It's more like poison at the moment. He's proposed that the UK keep between 15 and 18% of the fish quota caught in UK waters by EU fleets. The UK side is talking more like 80% rather than 18%. The Daily Telegraph reports that the EU might be ready to concede on Brexit fishing rights. As I said, we were talking, Jill Rutter and I, from Jill from the UK in a Changing Europe, whether this is domestically a political problem for for Emmanuel Macron, of course. We know that French workers in all sorts of sectors, pre-corona times, are always prepared to sort of take to the streets and blockade the country if they feel that their agricultural, or in this case fishing rights, are being impinged upon. So that's maybe quite a thorny thing, even though it's only about 0.13% of the British economy. Brussels has also accepted a British proposal for a transition period of fishing rights after the 1st of January, but there's no agreement on how long it should last or how it should work. Paris, of course, whose fishermen stand to lose the most, they've heaped pressure on Michel Barnier to stand firm on this. Clément Beaune, who's France's Europe minister, said there would be no trade deal without respecting European fishing interests. I'm not going to talk all about fish today, but as I said, that's the one word we got out of Barnier. Michel Barnier was, of course, on the issue of fish. Today, even though theoretically there's always something to talk about, I'd like to talk to Jill Rutter from the UK and Changing Europe a bit about your about citizens' rights, really, in that area. She's said to me she's a little bit wary. She's not a specialist on how it affects people living in Spain in particular. But, you know, as a fellow of the UK and Changing Europe, she's pretty much up there. If you needed an expert on Brexit, then she'd definitely be, say, in the top five, let's say. Maybe number one in that top five. And she'll be joining us a little later on in today's programme.
These are decisive days for our negotiations with the United Kingdom. But frankly, I cannot tell you today if in the end there will be a deal. There are still three issues that can make the difference between a deal and no deal. The crucial topics for the European side are, of course, questions linked to the level playing field, the governance, and fisheries. And with very little time ahead of us, we will do all in our power to reach an agreement. We're ready to be creative, but we are not ready to put into question the integrity of the single market. We want to know what remedies are available in case one side will deviate in the future. Because trust is good, but law is better. And crucially, in the light of recent experience, a strong governance system is essential to ensure that what has been agreed is actually done.
If you want to get in touch during the course of the programme, maybe you've got a question you'd like me to put to Jill or a comment, anything to do with Brexit, this is on Mondays, is dedicated to Brexit, then you can send me a WhatsApp message. The number is +34 722 177 507. That's +34 722 177 507.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
It's 10 minutes past 12. Remember the WhatsApp number, +34 722 177 507. So on the British side of this, of course, if some sort of deal is done, will Labour support it is the question going out there. There seems to be a standard opinion that Labour wouldn't vote against it because, you know, they fear no deal would be the worst of all worlds. The problem is, of course, if they vote with the government on this, then if it all goes belly up, not all of it, but, you know, the economic fallout, of course, for people right across the economy, then Labour will, of course, not be able to say nothing to do with us, Gov, if they voted for it. So the other option, of course, would be for Labour to abstain. But it seems, but that's not what they're going to do. These are the noises coming out of Westminster that Keir Starmer's preparing to risk a party rift by throwing Labour's weight behind a Brexit deal if last-minute negotiations succeed over the next few days, and with a three-line whip. So, members, it wouldn't be a free vote. Multiple sources have said that Starmer and the Cabinet Office Shadow Minister, Rachel Reeves, who she's been liaising with backbenchers on the issue, that they're minded to impose this three-line whip in support of a deal, subject to the detail, of course. They've rejected the idea of abstaining, or giving MPs a free vote, fearing that it would suggest that Labour's failed to absorb the lessons of the pasting that it took in December's general election, the last one. If a deal can be done, Boris Johnson is expected to bring it to Parliament before Christmas, most likely by tabling the Future Relationship Bill, or whatever they end up calling it. I think that's what they are calling it at the moment. They've been working on it for several months. That could potentially allow Labour to signal its lack of enthusiasm by tabling amendments, though they'd stand little chance of passing because of the 80-seat majority that Boris Johnson has. It means the deal would likely go through even if Labour abstained. But Starmer and his team think the consequences of a no-deal exit would be too dire for the party to stand on the sidelines. Even many of those MPs who fought hard during the previous parliament, the 2017 to 19 parliament, they fought for a people's vote, as it was called, you know, a second referendum, well, they're expected to fall in behind the leadership for the same reason. You know, the potentially disastrous consequences of no deal. They think supporting a Johnson deal would leave Labour unable to hold the government to account for Brexit's economic consequences, damage the party in Scotland as well, because, of course, that would allow the ones that aren't in favour of this is also the issue in Scotland, because it would allow Nicola Sturgeon to lump the Westminster parties together on the issue. One Labour insider said that the SNP will be cock-a-hoop over this. Boris Johnson was asked if all four nations will leave the EU. We're talking here, of course, about the issue of Northern Ireland having one foot in both camps. Remain aside the best of both worlds. yeah, that Northern Ireland would be able to be in the British customs union and also in the European Union's customs union. The only thing there, of course, it'd need to be paperwork with stuff, goods travelling between Britain and Northern Ireland. And then if they have to pay a tariff to get into the EU, those companies, if it's staying in Northern Ireland, would get a rebate. So this is what Boris Johnson was asked.
Prime Minister.
Yes, yes, indeed. I can make that guarantee, Mr. Speaker. And our position on fish hasn't changed. We'll only be able to make progress if the EU accepts the reality that we must be able to control access to our waters. And it's very important at this stage to emphasise that.
Hmm. So who would have thought, you know, that fish would be such a big sticking point, especially as it's such a small part of the economy. Some of the things that change, of course, it's looming. Obviously, the 31st of December, so we've got 31 days. And, of course, some of them is a weekend and Christmas, just to complicate matters further. And, of course, there's some major changes for anyone going from the UK to continental Europe, or the other way around, clearly, either to holiday, work or live. Some of the issues have been confirmed, but others are dependent on whether we get a deal or not. We've had a look at a few in the past, but just to reiterate or to go over some different areas for you. If you already live in the EU, so many of you listening, not all of you, of course, are listening, say, in Spain or Germany or wherever, some in the UK, you're all equally welcome, of course. If you already live in the EU and draw a state pension from the UK, your payment will go up each year in line with the triple lock. That's the rate of inflation, average earnings, or 2.5%, whichever is the highest figure. Even if you don't claim a pension yet, when you start doing so, you'll get the same as if you lived in the UK, and that will hold for your lifetime. So if you're in the EU now and you're not retiring for another 5 or 10 years, if you're officially in now, that will continue to apply, the triple lock. Remember, the rules will apply to any EU citizen, British or otherwise, who's paid their national contributions in the UK. If you've worked in several countries, then your contributions will be aggregated and payable just as they are now under the withdrawal agreement signed in January. 585 odd pages. There's a lot of detail in there. This is the legally binding document. And so it guarantees that your pension will go up with a triple lock. For anyone who, this is those of you already living in the EU, if you're just in the UK and plan on staying there for the rest of your life, then that also applies, of course. But for anyone who moves to the European Union after January, you'll still be able to claim your UK state pension, but how much you get will depend on whether there's a deal or not. A draft agreement on social security drawn up by the UK government puts forward a system whereby pensioners in the EU will receive the same as if they'd remained in Britain. If you're moving to Ireland, Ireland's always a different issue between Ireland and the UK, then you still benefit from the annual rise, whatever happens, deal or no deal. There's a coalition of campaign groups for British nationals who are either settled in the EU now or wonder, about to live in the European Union, thinking about making the jump now, British in Europe. And they've put together a useful set of guides on benefits about the future. I mean, I'm just looking here. The withdrawal agreement, what it is, what does it do, what does it cover? You can have this as a PDF file. Residence rights and procedures, health, pension, social security, working rights, professional qualifications, future family reunification. It gets a bit muddy sometimes if you're British, you want to go back and your husband or wife is different nationality and so on, all the requirements there. What's not covered in the withdrawal agreement? Various things that they have. Anyway, it's very useful. If you would like a copy of that, then just send me on WhatsApp the word guide and I'll send you the link. Okay? This is explains all your rights under the withdrawal agreement in, you know, in layman's terms, in plain English. I mean, it's pretty plain English in the withdrawal agreement, but 585 pages of legalese might lead to some confusion, just die of boredom, perhaps. So send me the word guide in a WhatsApp, and then either during or after the programme, I'll send you the link to that. One person who has vowed not to to meddle in the Brexit talks is Guy Verhofstadt.
First of all, I don't want to intervene on Brexit. I think that we are in injury time.
like we say in football, in these negotiations. But I'm still optimistic, Mr. McAllister, because I think that it's not like football. Footballers are tired in injury time. Politicians not. Politicians are at their best, I think, in injury time. And I hope, and I'm still optimistic, because it's in the interest of both. To have this agreement.
Hmm. Apart from leading the Liberal group in Parliament, that Guy Verhofstadt is he's the point man, he's the go-to man, the liaison between the Commission, Barnier's team, and the European Parliament on the subject of Brexit. So if a deal is done, then the Commission, of course, will put it to the Council, and the Council say yes, presumably, and then it goes to the Parliament. But these things go before two select committees before they go to the main chamber, and Guy Verhofstadt is the main man there. So it's a free vote, of course, but usually they make recommendations, so he might well influence how MEPs vote. Presumably, if it's got past the Commission and the Council, presumably under the UK Parliament, of course, the other side, the Parliament won't stand in the way, the European Parliament. The issue of healthcare, of course, is one of the issues that hasn't been settled yet, is reciprocal healthcare. UK citizens living in Europe, in the EU, of course, before the end of 2020, and EU citizens living in Britain will still be entitled to access healthcare as they do now. But anyone relocating after that could find the situation is different, unless a deal is agreed. There's optimism in some. Of course, they'll do this. They'll allow this. But that's all it is. There's no reason why it should be. It's not engraved in stone or anywhere, really. It's not written down yet. Only some groups will definitely continue to benefit from free healthcare. That's Irish citizens moving to Britain and vice versa, students studying in the EU, and people who hold an S1 form from the UK, which is for pensioners and people receiving certain state benefits. That's, of course, the resident health card. So in Spain, the SIP card. The EHIC card, of course, the one used to travel. Currently, anyone on a temporary stay in the EU should get this EHIC card from the British government. Wherever you're registered for, you know, for tax residency or your work. So in the case of me, it's my EHIC is the Spanish one, not a British one. after the transition period, an EHIC issued in the UK won't be valid as things stand. That applies to EU nationals living in Britain. As I say, the entitlement flows from tax residency and not birth nationality. So we're likely to see, many are saying, a like-for-like replacement scheme with the EU as a whole, but nothing's been signed off yet. The good news is that after December of this year, after the end of the transition, the scheme will still work for some groups of people from Britain. The students, as I say, studying in the EU, they can get a card, but it's valid only in the country where they're studying. Also, if you're living in the EU before the end of this year, you'll be allowed an EHIC card issued in that country that will be valid in the UK and elsewhere. Then, of course, the issue of travel insurance, when it's possible to travel, again, without corona restrictions, of course, if there are no arrangements in place, you'll need to make sure you have travel insurance. Thing is that, you know, even if you get private insurance now, often what happens is that there are cheaper policies and they come with a provider that you need an EHIC card. So the provider, say, you say go on holiday to Italy, have a skiing accident, for example. Well, first of all, you need to exhaust all the stuff that you can get on the EHIC card, and then we'll top you up with extra benefits. I don't know, a private room, better food, whatever it may be, but, you know, extra things based on that. So just even standard travel insurance might become more expensive if you haven't got that, you know, basic insurance EHIC card. The driving issue mentioned before, a couple of people have since asked, but if you're planning a trip to Europe that involves driving, under current arrangements, you'll need some extra documents when you go. Anyone driving their own vehicle will need to have a so-called green card. That's proof that you're insured. You get that from your car insurer. And they say, make sure the Department of Transport says, make sure you ask for it a month before you plan to travel. You might also need an international driving permit to drive in some countries, but it's not clear which countries may ask for it. Currently, no EU countries are on the list. You can get them in post offices. It's £5.50, so it's not going to break the bank, but I told you I got one, and I mistakenly thought it was instead of my, what was it, my Spanish driving lessons then. I had an international Spanish driving permit when traveling around the world. And I think John and Mija said that, you, in fact, it's complementary in the sense that you're supposed to have your normal driving license plus that, not just that replacing your national license. And nobody was interested anyway. All they wanted was the money around the world. So there's some places that I went to, you know, Vietnam, Cambodia, and places renting, you know, scooters and motorbikes and cars and things. The pet passport thing, the United Kingdom has applied, is in the process of becoming a listed country. So maybe sort of peeling off a part of the deal, you know, if there's no deal on other stuff, probably will be on aviation, quite a big one. The UK wants to become a listed country, which will allow you to stay the same as you are now. It'll allow pets to be moved between the UK and the EU practically almost as freely as now. If that doesn't happen, then if you live in England, Scotland or Wales, you'll have to go through some hoops. You'll need to get an animal health certificate, and that'll involve waiting 3 months after a blood sample's been taken from your pet. So that's why they say you'll need to plan 4 months beforehand. 3 months, blood sample, a test that your dog or cat hasn't got anything dodgy, or your goldfish. Do they take a blood sample from a goldfish? Probably not. Northern Ireland is different, I suppose, because of wanting to leave the border open between the Republic and the North. So moving a pet between Northern Ireland and the EU, they say, will continue to be as easy as it is now. And then the other one, people ask, but we've mentioned it many times, but is the roaming charges. In the UK, the big three, EE, O2 and Vodafone, they've all said that they have no plans to introduce roaming charges. But if they wanted to change their policy, they could. The only protection, I suppose, you'd have from big bills is under a new UK rule on unexpected charges. And this is going to come into force from the 1st of January in the UK. And it applies a financial cap on mobile data usage overseas. So by law, they'll have to introduce the company some system that if you're roaming in Europe, your British phone contract, then your mobile data services, when it reaches £45, it'll stop. You won't be able to use any more data unless you actively opt in to use more. So you don't get a shock. You hear some of these horror stories, people like £1,000 bill and so on. And by law, the companies will have to send you an alert when you're at 80% of your usage and then at 100% of usage. And finally, on that one, customers in Northern Ireland will have, by law, an extra protection against inadvertent roaming in Ireland. That can happen near borders when a phone links to a mast in a different country, and providers will be obliged to help customers avoid those charges and special tariffs or messaging or something when people inadvertently roam. So I've had that, where was it, I think between Germany and Switzerland. One of you told me some while ago, was it between Italy and Croatia somewhere, that no, it wasn't. So one was an EU country, and so the roaming was free, no roaming, of course, around the European Union, but one of you was right next to the border with Albania, I can't remember, somewhere, I think, former Yugoslavia, that area, and linked to a, you know, a non-EU antenna and got an unpleasant surprise. Fortunately, not in the thousands, but, So that's, I suppose, where we are now. On the issue of migration, Priti Patel is... She was delighted, was it a week or two ago, that she said freedom of movement is ending, and this is great news. Obviously, it's not for many expats, creates headaches and unforeseen headaches in some cases. But she also signalled over the last couple of days that the UK and France have signed an historic deal to halt illegal migrants or undocumented migrants crossing the channel.
The joint agreement that I signed, which secured the joint intelligence operation, has made a difference even in the last 6 months, and we have seen that. So we know that the French authorities have stopped over 5,000 migrants from crossing into the United Kingdom. We've had hundreds of arrests, and that's because of the joint intelligence and communications that we share between both our authorities. This new package today that I have just signed with my French counterpart, the French Interior Interior Minister, effectively doubles the number of police on the French beaches. It invests in more technology, so more surveillance, more radar technology that supports a law enforcement effort. And on top of that, we are now sharing in terms of toughening up our border security. So on the French side in particular, they are now focused on strengthening their border security because we are seeing fewer migrants now in small boats, but we're seeing displacement into other areas such as lorries. And so as a result, this is a joint effort. As all our efforts have been, our two countries stand shoulder to shoulder when it comes to dealing with illegal migration. But we are now looking not just at the strategy, but the type of tactical interventions that our two countries can undertake together.
So Priti Patel there. Somebody here, it's been forwarded to me, I just wonder why the fishing dispute couldn't be settled by issuing a licence to EU nations at a price while retaining the right to withdraw the licence at any time in the future. I can tell you that the EU doesn't want that. This is something Norway has, something where it's renegotiated every year. And it just maybe a bit like Switzerland, where Switzerland have got these, you know, dozens and dozens of bilateral agreements with Switzerland, loads of different things. And the UK wanted to do something like that. So cherry pick, let's sign off on this little bit and that little bit and that little bit. No, no, no. We've had the headache of Switzerland. We're not going to make that mistake again. Right. OK, well, your questions are coming in. But in just a sec, we'll speak to Jill Rutter from the UK in a Changing Europe.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
It's 12:33, an hour earlier in the Canary Islands, Portugal, the Republic of Ireland and the UK, of course. I'm glad to be joined again on the line by Jill Rutter from the UK in a Changing Europe. Hi, Jill.
Hiya, Stephen.
Hi. So, well, since we last spoke, possibly for this programme, it's one of the worst days ever because it seems like tumbleweed, nothing. The only word I could manage to get from Barnier that I managed to hear walking down the street being sort of doorstepped was he just said, he mumbled very quietly, but he said, poisson, fish. Okay.
I thought you were saying croissant, but anyway, that would be different. But anyway.
And I was saying earlier, you could have taken an S out of the poisson and just made it poison, because there's some people suggesting that's where we are at the moment. Well, first of all, where do you think we're at? I mean, are we less or more optimistic than last week?
Well, there's more briefing that this is the make or break week, but we have sort of heard that quite a lot of times before. We do know that we are a week closer to that 31st of December deadline, and people are making noises about some of the sort of, you know, issues you might go to actually get approval if they do a deal. I think it's quite a lot of debate, certainly over here, clearly that the British government is pumping out the line that it's down to the fish now, and that the EU has moved from its issue of principle of no change and accepted that there'll be some increase in British fishing rights in UK waters, but that the UK has dismissed that as derisory. Other people are saying actually there's a bit of a smokescreen being put up by the British government, and actually the big differences remain on the very famous, much discussed level playing field set of issues. So I think we discussed those last week. So so we do seem to be going round. It seems to be Groundhog Day yet again. But this time in London, we're told the negotiators were up late last night negotiating, so we will see if any white smoke emerges.
I like the white smoke analogy. The next European Council meeting's on the 10th of December, so 10 days away from now. I suppose that'll be another deadline that may come or go. I noticed that a couple of days ago, Guy Verhofstadt, of course, who's the point man in the European Parliament on Brexit issues, he said essentially he's staying out of this. He, once upon a time, was a champion of guaranteeing British citizens post-Brexit, citizens who are already registered in the EU or will be, you know, resident officially by the end of the year, the ability to move around. Because one thing is, for example, you know, say our listeners in Spain, the listeners elsewhere, because our FM listeners are in Spain, that they'll be allowed to stay forever and ever, yeah, with, you know, under the withdrawal agreement deal. But if they decided in a few years' time that they wanted to go and live in Italy, then they couldn't. So they're stuck in one country.
Yes, that was an issue actually that the UK was quite keen to put on the agenda under Theresa May's government in the withdrawal agreement talks. But the EU said, no, you can't. We won't talk about that now. That's an issue for the future relationship negotiation. But I think that's sort of not really under discussion. We don't hear much about what's being discussed on mobility, a bit about, you know, the potential for sort of things like youth mobility exchanges and that sort of thing. But I think that may be one of the things that is not settled in this in a deal as is. The EU has taken quite a restrictive view of all the stuff that the UK originally asked for in terms of making it easier for people, for UK citizens, you know, whether based here or indeed based in the sort of, you know, based in EU countries to do business in other places after Brexit. So I'm not sure that I would be holding out that much hope of an agreement, particularly if it's a very sort of bare bones, skinny sort of deal. It might be something that governments come round to afterwards, but I think we'll have to wait to see the texts that emerge.
There are reports coming out, but it's all sort of unnamed sources around the Westminster lobby, that Keir Starmer is going to whip his party into support, you know, upon examination of the deal, but he's going to whip them to vote in favour of it rather than abstain, for example, or have a free vote. Do you think that's advisable? I mean, the SNP will have a field day with that, clearly.
It's obviously for Keir Starmer to decide, but it does seem to be quite divisive for Labour. Clearly, if you're there from Labour, they've been arguing all year, you said you could get a Brexit deal done, get a Brexit deal done. Labour clearly felt that part of its electoral defeat last year, particularly its loss of the so-called red wall seats in the Midlands and the North to the Conservatives, those seats that the Conservatives won that they hadn't won for, you know, decades, if in living memory at all, was due to their sort of apparent refusal to accept the results of the referendum. And Keir Starmer was deemed to be the sort of, if you like, the personification of that Brexit denialism. So just as we used to talk sometimes about whether Theresa May's, you know, quite hard line on Brexit was because she was a bit of an overcompensating Remainer in a Leave party, I think there's a bit of an element that Keir Starmer wants at all costs to avoid giving Boris Johnson or whoever's Conservative leader by the time of the next election the ability to say Labour still doesn't accept the outcome of the referendum. So I think that's why they certainly wouldn't vote against a deal. And they also realise that, are of the view that no deal is a much worse outcome than a deal. The problem, I think, for Labour is that if it votes for a deal, and we've been talking all along about it being a very thin deal, a sort of thinner deal than the one potentially that Theresa May might have negotiated, is will Labour then be forced to take responsibility for what's in that deal? It's sort of, you know, if it votes for it, will it still be able to say, well, look, we warned you that, putting up all these regulatory barriers between the UK and the single market would lead to the closure of car firms, this, that and the other. So, you know, so I think that's part of the political judgment is, can they find a way of still holding Boris Johnson accountable for the consequences of his deal? Because they, at some point, will want to argue this isn't the sort of deal Labour would have done. And indeed, Labour will try potentially and negotiate a better deal. Sounds a bit like Harold Wilson, doesn't it? Negotiate a better arrangement in the future with the EU. And if they've tripped into the lobbies, but I think if it gets to a stage where Boris Johnson has real problems with the Conservative backbenchers, if they all say, well, actually, we hate your deal, we'd rather have no deal, then I think that Boris Johnson probably could rely on Labour votes to get it through. But as you've said...
Especially if it's true that Keir Starmer's going to whip them, you might get the odd rebel, Jeremy Corbyn, if he's back in by then.
Jeremy Corbyn, I think, you know, is just keen to... probably just keen to get the UK out of the EU insofar as he deeply cares about it at all. But I think undoubtedly there'll be a lot of rebellions on that, I think. So I think, yeah.
No, I mean, obviously the problem is, of course, if they vote, you know, they vote in favour, then the Conservatives forever after can say, well, you supported it, just as it was a problem for, politically speaking, when Conservatives, not all of them, of course, but when the Conservatives supported Tony Blair over the Iraq War, the finger was pointed at Labour, but it hardly ever comes up, the fact that most Conservatives voted in favour of it as well. So that maybe keep a few people quiet. And I've got to listen at Joe Byrne. He says, hi, Stephen and Jill. Do you have any idea of what's been agreed in the talks so far, apart from the fisheries and courts issues? Do we know? Is it basically whatever we can think of, apart from fish? And the other two things, you know, the governance
and fish and level playing,
and level playing field.
I think, you know, broadly speaking, both sides are in the same place on tariff-free trade. We don't know whether they've agreed some of the sort of, you know, second-order things like sort of customs facilitation, streamlining regulatory checks, whether there's much of that in there. We think they've probably done some agreements. They've said they've moved quite a lot closer on security cooperation, but I don't think that's going to go as far as allowing the UK very easy access to lots of EU databases, which has been one of the sort of UK asks, because we're not going to get better deals on that than member states get or EEA members. There'll be an aviation deal. I think they've probably agreed the outlines of that, which will be a bit more restrictive for UK registered airlines with majority UK ownership than they are now.
Everybody seems to think that we will get a, you know, it'd just be childish and petty to not have some sort of, you know, similar thing to the open skies arrangement with aviation. But often, because you and I, perhaps, unless you have a side business on the side, but we're not involved in the, say, freight. And there are issues that seem are not part of these things. Like, for example, if a British plane lands in Belgium, wants to drop some stuff off and then fly to Germany, you pick some stuff up there. So moving around from one EU airport to another,
I think they have to do all the paperwork. Yeah, I think the bits about cabotage rights, both for trucks and planes, so your ability to pick up in one area, you know, between two EU points, so rather than just do point to point. So all the point to point stuff, yeah, I think, will be allowed, but you know, the sort of ability to fly London to Madrid to Milan or something like that, that Madrid to Milan route, I think you probably won't be allowed to. The UK was.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere, it was a couple of months ago. I was reading somewhere that the plan was for cabotage to be limited, so almost like a quota on it. You know, you could do a bit, take your lorry to Paris, drop some stuff off, go to Berlin, pick some more stuff, take it to Madrid, but there'd be a quota rather than just being, you know, pretty free at the moment. Yeah.
We don't know where they've got to on that because we haven't seen the legal text. The UK was arguing for that on the grounds that it was the one area where the UK really conceded that geography was an issue by saying there was sort of, you know, because of the geography, it made much more sense. And I think they were also pointing, I think, the UK text to the environmental benefits, because obviously if you're concerned about carbon emissions and things like that and congestion, you don't want loads of empty trucks making unnecessary journeys. So, again, the EU's been very concerned about the UK adherence to regulations on driver working hours and has been, you know, very reluctant to have the UK able to compete with continental
companies. I noticed that there's a new ferry service. It's a Danish company. They're going to be starting sailing between Dunkirk in France and Rosslare in Ireland from the 2nd of January. And this, of course, is to avoid, you know, the British bridge where goods go from the Republic to typically, say, to Wales, maybe, or Liverpool, I'm not sure, but and then down and back, you know, to France. And of course, they'll be leaving the EU, then have to go back into the EU. This, I see the capacity for 125 lorries. They'll do six sailings a week from each port. It'll take 24 hours, so quite a long time, I suppose. But so maybe that's one sort of unintended consequence, is the bypassing, you know, British port business as well.
Yeah, I think there have been a few talks about sort of new ferry routes opening up. I think there's some point some people were talking about Rosslare, Santander and things like that. So that, yeah, because at the moment there is a huge, big, you know, land bridge where ferries come into Holyhead from Dublin or whatever and drive across and go through the channel routes. And obviously they're going to be facing potential administrative delays multiple places if you do that. So you can see why you would want those new routes opened up. In fact, I mean, I suppose you could argue that that will actually help out the UK as well, because it would reduce the volumes having to go through those pinch points of the Channel ports.
Just one final thing. You teased an idea a little bit earlier when you said, let's suppose, for example, there's a bare bones deal, and then let's suppose that a Labour government comes in at whatever time, the 2024, who's the next one, whenever, and that they decide to renegotiate, not scrap the deal, but to build on it, to make more flesh on the bone. Do you think there's any possibility, given that public opinion at the moment can be fickle, is, you know, there are more people that say they think Brexit, on reflection, was a bad idea than think it was a good idea. There are various polls, but generally that. Do you think there's any possibility that that a Labour government might apply to join the single market and or the customs union?
That would be very much, I think, for Labour to think through. I think the big problem, and the big problem actually in Labour formulating its position, Labour, remember, was pro being in the customs union, but not pro being in, well, didn't say it wanted to be in the single market. It used to have this language about a close relationship with the single market, because back when we were trying to figure out what Brexit meant in the immediate aftermath of the referendum, the big issue for a lot of Labour MPs was that their constituents very much not like freedom of movement. One of the things we have seen since the referendum is a huge big change in public opinion in the UK about the benefits of inward migration. And actually, I think, you know, if you read the British press, I don't know how many of your listeners read the British press, you will see increasing numbers of concerns being expressed. I think the Daily Telegraph, the Sunday Telegraph yesterday, had a big story about the third country rules applying to Brits who own second homes abroad, and that they would be limited by the rules to 90 days in 180. So one of the really interesting
Sunday Times had a big piece on that yesterday.
Do attitudes to freedom of movement change? I mean, you know, and it's also possible, if the EU evolves, I mean, I think that's the other thing, is that we talk about as though the EU is a static being, but if the EU changes very much, then, you know, we might be
under pressure from Hungary or Poland or the like.
At the moment, I think Labour will want to make sure it doesn't have to talk too much about the EU.
I suppose, the most glaring precedent is that if we did sort of rejoin the customs union, single market, some sort of way, but for God's sake, don't call it that. You know, just like, for example, we hear this ridiculous phrase, an Australian-style deal. It's just playing semantics, and maybe that's what might happen. We'll have to leave it here, but Matthias, a listener, he says, reminder, none of the political or economic problems of the UK were caused by freedom of movement. Not a single one of them will be solved by ending freedom of movement, but many will be exacerbated. I think, apart from, you know, that blue wall that came in, of course, people feel that might be generally true, but people, if they notice it in their local neighbourhood, feel perhaps left behind. Jill Rutter from the UK in a Changing Europe, always a pleasure, and of course, highly informative. Thanks for being with us.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
It's 12:54. You would think that with what Jill was saying there, you know, the issue of data, very important thing in the European Union, so you don't have access to certain data and things have to be on certain servers on a European, physically, somewhere in the European Union or EEA, the server has to be there. You'd think they'd be, you know, quite conscious about security. But Zoom meetings can sometimes go wrong. You know, these video conferencing things. As a Dutch journalist took advantage of a security blunder and he hacked into a confidential video call with EU defence ministers. And this meeting was being chaired by Josep Borrell, of course, who's the EU's top diplomat. His name is Daniel Ferlan, and he's from RTL News. And he all of a sudden popped up in a large window. If you've done these Zoom meetings, he popped up in a large window at the top of the video conference screen, grinning and waving to these 27 defence ministers, plus Josep Borrell. How he did this, he used information... Sure, some people are a bit lax anyway, but from a Twitter post by the Dutch Defence Minister, Ank Bijleveld. This is the Dutch Defence Minister. The minister had published a photo of herself working from home while taking part in the conference, and the post included a photo of her laptop screen with her EU counterparts visible, and another picture, which has since been removed, showed five digits of a six-digit PIN needed to gain access to the call. Because if you've done, I've done them a few times, these Zoom calls. We've had a couple at TRE, you know, production meetings and things like that. So you can have them sort of free to all, or you can have them so that only people with the link, a bit like with my Google Drive or your Apple iCloud, works the same sort of way. Or you can have it with a six-number PIN. So you need to put that security code in order to access this. So she'd shown five numbers, presumably... it only takes 10 guesses if you're completely unlucky before you manage to get in. And he did. Borrell, there was a lot of laughing going on, but Josep Borrell himself had a bit of a serious message to this guy.
How are you? How are you?
Hi. Hi, I'm fine. How are you? Hi.
You know that you have been jumping into a secret conference of the Anti-UBA?
So he said, you know, you've been jumping into a secret conference. So much a secret.
Yeah, yes, I'm sorry. I'm a journalist from the Netherlands. I'm sorry for interrupting your conference. So I'll be leaving here. So thank you.
That's a criminal offense, huh?
He's saying that it's a criminal offense, huh?
You know. So you better shut off quickly. Before the police arrive, huh?
Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you.
So, if you can do that, I mean, with the resources of the Chinese and Russian intelligence services or Iranian or whoever else, the United States, anyone else who wants to get in, then it probably isn't that difficult, is it? Ray in La Manga says... Okay, it's a joke here, and it's a bit rude, but thank you. I'll have a look at that afterwards. Margaret in Torrox says, I've been using an international driving license from the UK post office because I have a Spanish car, but Torrox police didn't know what it was, and I showed them my UK license. Says, any info on whether snowbirds can get a visa so that we can stay longer than 90 days? Well, you know... Obviously, the general rule is going to be you can stay in 90 days in any 180 days, but not 180 in any 360. Key difference there. And your passport probably will be stamped in and stamped out, as it is if you go to most countries around the world.
Talk Radio Europe presents Countdown to Brexit.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.